And now for something completely different.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is time for Chat with a Cat, episode 22. This is being recorded after sim number 7. That's the All-Star sim. But before the trade deadline, I'll probably have another one a little bit later on reacting to any trades that come in as we get close to the trade deadline. But I thought this one would be more interesting to react to as far as the All-Star weekend. There were some things that I was kind of looking at as I was going over the All-Star results that struck me as interesting and maybe worthy of chatting a little bit about, so I thought I would go ahead and go with that. I'm going to start by talking about the rookie-sophomore game in the All-Star weekend. And for those of you that didn't catch it on the forums, the rookie starters were Ralph Sampson of the Celtics, Randy Brewer of the Jazz, Dale Ellis of the Nets, Clyde Drexler of the Nuggets, and Doc Rivers of the Mavericks. The bench was Mark West of the Spurs, Sidney Green of the Suns, Thurl Bailey of the Trailblazers, Byron Scott of the Spurs, John Paxson of the Cavaliers, Darryl Walker of the Pacers, and Roy Hinson of the Rockets. Your sophomore starters were Mark Eaton of the Bulls, Terry Cummings of the Pistons, Dominique Wilkins of the Supersonics, James Worthy and Lester Connor of the Trailblazers. Your bench was Chuck Navid of the Jazz, LaSalle Thompson of the Bulls, Rod Higgins of the Clippers, Fat Lever of the Nets, Sleepy Floyd of the Bucks, Ricky Pierce of the Rockets, and Paul Pressey of the Pistons. The very first thing that I thought about was, what does the rookie and sophomore game teach us about how well the league as a whole drafts? I'm not talking individual teams, do they draft well, do they draft poorly, but how well do we as a league do at getting the best players at the top of the draft? And at least initially, it looks like we're maybe not as good this season as we think we are. Although last season, I think we did do a good job. And here's how I went about looking at this. I looked at the players that were in the rookie-sophomore game, and I asked, okay, where were they drafted, and were they mostly drafted among the top players? And let's start with the rookies. Clyde Drexler was the number one overall pick. Dale Ellis, the number two overall pick. Ralph Sampson, the number four overall pick. Doc Rivers, the number six overall pick. And Randy Brewer was the 11th pick. Byron Scott, who was the 5th pick, was on the bench. So of the starting five, 4 of those players were in the top 6 picks. So I think at the top of the draft, pretty decent job was done of getting players right. Now, Randy Brewer of the Jazz starting maybe is a little bit of a surprise, but then we also can remember that this season's draft was almost entirely guards, and so there's probably room for a big to kind of creep in there. I think Dale Ellis might have been a guard during the draft and was moved to small forward during the season. If you look at the bench, Mark West was the 15th pick, Sidney Green 16, Thurl Bailey 12, John Paxson 17, Darryl Walker 14, Roy Hinson 10. You would expect with 12 players on the team, most of these players should be pick 12. And yet we had several guys that were after it. I mean, pick 14 is right after it, 15, 16, 17. So not terribly badly done. But then the question is, what happened on those other picks? And the thing that I looked at is, who were the players that were picked more highly than those players that made the team? And in this case, it was the number 3 pick was Derek Harper at the Hawks. Number 7 pick was Craig Gilo at the Hawks. When we were going through things in draft previews, we noted both of these guys were extremely high on potential but low on current, and so didn't expect much out of them early this season, and that has played out. Jeff Malone of the Bucks, I think, had the talent to play well this season, but he's on a deep enough team that he's not going to see playing time. And then you've got Sadale 3 to the 76ers, another player with high talent but low currents. And then I guess the one slight outlier was Steve Stepanovic, who was picked at 13. And, you know, he's not in the game. He's not making huge contributions. But at 13, is that really an awful pick? I have to say the answer is no. And so then I went and looked at the sophomore team, and, you know, there your number one pick last season was Dominique. He was on the starting five. Your number two pick, Ricky Pierce, on the bench. Three, Fat Lever, on the bench. Four, Terry Pitt Cummings, starting five. Five, James Worthy, starting five. Six, Paul Pressey, on the bench. Seven, Sleepy Floyd, on the bench. It's not so you get down to Clark Kellogg with the number eight pick that you find a guy that isn't on the team. And there are only two guys outside the top 12 picks that made the team, and that was Lester Connor at point guard. He was picked 15th. And Chuck Nevitt of the Jazz, who was picked number 25. So he was actually a second-round pick. So that one was kind of interesting to me. You know, how did we miss on Chuck Nevitt? Although maybe it's not how did we miss, because if you look at the rest of the players that were picked, there weren't any centers. And remember, the rookie and sophomore teams are very much position-based, just like the All-Star teams. There are always two centers, four forwards, four guards, and then the last two spots are wild card spots, I guess you could call them. And so for the sophomores, getting 10 out of the top 12 picks on the team. For the rookies, out of the top 12 picks, you had eight on the team. So I think the answer to that question is generally we do pretty well at picking young players. And so that was something that I thought was interesting. Now, you can argue that, you know, individual specific teams maybe didn't do a great job. But in general, at least as far as the rookie sophomores go, yeah, teams do a pretty good job. So then I thought, well, can I extrapolate that and look at the All-Star teams and see how that has gone? And if we look at the Western Conference, if you look at the starters, it was Robert Parrish, who was the number four pick in the creation draft. Moses Malone, the number three pick. Magic Johnson, the number one pick. Calvin Knapp was the number 37 pick, and Reggie Theus was the number five pick. So of the top five picks in the draft, four of them were starters on the West. This isn't necessarily saying the West is, you know, better than the East or anything. It's just, you know, identifying that with the top five picks, and I should note the guy who was the number two pick was Larry Bird, who was one of the guys on the bench, so still on the All-Star team. You know, the number six overall pick, Kiki Vandeweghe, he's on the team. So at least with the top picks in the creation draft, we did pretty well. Then you look at the rest of the team. You know, Mike Gminski was pick number 40. That's second round of the creation draft. Bernard King, 27, second round of the creation draft. Ricky Green, 62. That's, by my math, the third round of the creation draft. And then you look at the only two guys that are on the West that weren't in the creation draft. Dominique Wilkins, who was the number one overall pick in 82, and Clyde Drexler, who was the number one pick overall in 83. So on the West, you could say Ricky Green is kind of the outlier, but everybody else was a pick toward the top of the creation draft, either first or second round, or the number one overall pick. Going over to the East, you know, similarly, we have in the starting lineup, Kevin McHale, who was the number 10 overall pick. Sidney Moncrief, the number 8 overall pick. Adrian Dantley, the number 11 overall pick. Maurice Cheeks, the number 21 overall pick. Alex English and Dennis Johnson were picks 19 and 18, respectively. So these were all first-round picks in the creation draft. Your second-round picks in the creation draft were Johnny Moore at 25, Joe Barry Carroll at 36. And then you had Daryl Dawkins, who's a, you know, a bit of an outlier, maybe like Ricky Green at number 60. And then you look at who you had in the rookie draft since. Larry Nance from the 81 draft was number 4 overall. Terry Cummings of the Pistons, number 4 overall. Ralph Sampson of the Celtics, number 4 overall. So again, All-Stars are coming with one or two exceptions. Again, Ricky Green and Daryl Dawkins are the outliers, are coming from the top picks. So that tells me that, by and large, This group of owners gets it right when it comes to drafting. Now, the other thing that I think is curious, and this could be a law of small numbers thing, I just thought it was kind of interesting to note, that if you're an all-star this season, you were either drafted in the creation draft, or you were the number one or the number four overall pick, which then kind of begged the question, you know, what about the number two and the number three overall picks? And, you know, what happened there and how did they do? Are we getting wrong? You know, we know in the real NBA, there's something of a, I don't want to say a draft curse, but perhaps a notion that the number two pick generally underperforms. So, you know, let's talk about that for a minute. If we go back to the 1981 draft and look at who was picked second overall, that was Jeff Ruland, who's currently on the Hawks and who's playing decently, but I would not say is the threat to make an all-star team anytime soon. The number three pick was Isaiah Thomas of the Spurs. I think Thomas has a shot to make an all-star team in the relatively near future. I think Ricky Green of the Supersonics is likely to fade a little bit, and that's going to open up maybe a spot for Isaiah. I guess it depends on how this draft goes. If we look at the 1982 draft, the number two selection was Ricky Pierce, and the number three selection was Fat Lever. And we all know, you know, Fat probably is missing out because of his broken leg. And then in the most recent draft, you know, who was picked number two? Well, that was Dale Ellis, who we saw made the all-rookie team and looks like he's got a good career ahead of him. And the number three pick was, as we talked about before, Derek Harper, a player that has a lot of long-term potential but isn't there yet. So maybe this is a little bit premature to look at, you know, how do we do as drafting as a league. But, you know, then again, it might be interesting to think about that in terms of when we're drafting players, and we talk a lot about, you know, tanking and building and trust the process and prepping. When you tank, how long does it take you to come out of the tank, and how frequent is it that you draft a top player? And it looks like there's, on average, two All-Stars drafted each season, and both of them are in the top four. So unless you are a lottery winner, or maybe just outside the lottery, because I know number four in this is currently a lottery thing in the NBA, but it's not in this iteration of Fast Break, you're not going to come away with an All-Star. And that probably means your team is not going to turn it around very quickly. So that was just something that, you know, for all of the talk and hand-wringing and tanking and everybody's trying to get ready for draft position and, you know, I'm selling off my team to build for the future, it's too early to tell now, but the question that I would have is, are you really able to turn around, and are you sure you're going to get that guy? I mean, we know lottery odds, the best odds, the worst team in the league only has a 25% chance of picking number one overall. And then, you know, how worth it is it if five or six teams are trying to tank, because one of those teams is going to get an all-star, and the other four or five are probably out of luck. So, you know, there was talk about competitive balance and salary floors and all that. And again, it's just something interesting to think about, that if you're thinking of tanking, how long is it going to take you to come back out? That maybe goes back to a discussion we had last year about hanging on to your draft picks. I would submit that if you're even contemplating draft or tanking at any point, you need to hang on to all of your draft picks. And conversely, if you have traded your draft picks away, even one that is 2 years out, it's probably not a good idea to consider tanking in the current season. We'll see how it plays out next year and see which teams can bounce back quickly. But so far, It doesn't seem like, other than the Bucks, anybody has been able to have a one-season turnaround. And the Bucks really didn't tank. They sold their team off for different pieces. And so perhaps they're a bit of an outlier. I'm going to take a break here because I think I've harped enough on this and given everybody enough pats on the back for drafting well. And once I come back, we're going to come back and look at some trends that kind of surprised me as we went into the All-Star break. And also, there were a couple of trade posts made. I get the feeling, you know, that there's going to be some reaction to those. I know one of them was my own, so I'm going to be brief on that one. But there is something I want to talk about with the Suns Bullets trade that is still kind of pending. So we'll be back shortly to talk about that.
Good evening. In the news this hour, a group of over 400 middle-aged men and women have reportedly convened in Washington, D.C. today for the purpose of making what they call laws. Not much is known about these laws at this time, but early indications are that this group intends for them to act as a sort of guideline for the behavior of American citizens. We'll bring you the full story of this so-called House of Representatives and exactly who it is they represent tonight. More after this.
Bye, Mom. I'm going to school.
Hold on there, young man. You forgot your lunch.
Oh, Mom, it's not peanut butter and jelly again, is it?
Not today, Scooter. Today, you're getting Splat.
Splat? All right!
Introducing Splat. Spreadable lips, anuses, and teats. Moms love it because it spreads like butter. Kids love it because it goes down easy. And best of all, Splat uses the parts of animals usually bound for the trash heap. And in today's waste-conscious world, that's important.
Spreadable lips, anuses, and teats.
Splat!
The yummy alternate.
Splat! Remember, if it spits, craps, or squirts, it's in there.
In other news, Splat lunch meat has been linked to cancer, blindness, anxiety, and male pattern baldness in laboratory rats. Learn more tonight.
Good lunch, Mom.
Oops. Billy, your mouth! Look out!
Oh, Billy.
Out of my way, you old bag.
Who are you, and what are you doing in my house?
I'm the brazen paper towel man, and I'm here to clean up that spill, unless you'd rather use that wimpy, sorry-ass paper towel you usually use.
Well, how good is brazen?
How good is brazen? Shut your trap and I'll tell you.
Hey, you can't talk to my mom like that!
Shut up, punk, or I'll smack you on the back of the head with my class ring. Brazen paper towels eat spills for breakfast. One single sheet of brazen will sop up a small, scummy pond. See that milk?
Yes.
Well, watch this, baby.
What was that scream?
That was the milk, begging for mercy.
Brazen paper towels. We're an Arthur Daniels Heartland company, but you don't need to know that.
All right, we are back. As promised, I wanted to touch very briefly on some of the trades that recently went down, and then we'll get into examining some of the trends among some of the teams, at least as I see them. Coming out of the All-Star break, there were three posted trades, two of which were successful, one which was not. Let's talk about them quickly. I'm going to start actually with the Celtics-Clippers trade. In this one, the Celtics sent Wes Matthews to the Clippers for Bryan Taylor and 6 points. This one is pretty easy to understand. Bryan Taylor was out of the rotation for the Clippers and making close to $500,000. The Clippers are over the cap by about that amount, so this drops them. I don't know if it quite gets them under the cap. I didn't look at Wes Matthews' salary, but it almost certainly takes them out of the luxury tax range. So this was the Celtics taking on some points so that the Clippers didn't have to hit the luxury tax. Again, pretty obvious what both teams are doing here. The second trade was the Suns Trailblazers trade. I'm only going to touch on this one because I thought it was kind of interesting, funny, I don't know what you call it, where the commissioner made a comment on the Discord channel that, oh, suddenly Wig's lineup changes make sense, and the lineup changes in question were basically me taking Eddie Johnson, Juwan Oldham, Paul McKeskey, and John Drew and throwing them onto IR. And I joked a little bit in return, you know, yes, it does make sense. I'm not tanking. And there has been, I think, traditionally a lot of angst and worry and hand-wringing shed over whether or not a team that benches players ahead of a trade deadline is tanking or protecting their assets. I think in my case, even if I was trying to tank, you know, we went on a win streak during the sim, so obviously it didn't help. But I should say, you know, where do I fall on this? I do think taking a player that is involved in a pending trade and throwing them on IR for one sim, maybe two sims, is definitely not a tank move. It's protecting the trade, especially if there's already a trade in the works. And so when I see a move like that, when I see players unexpectedly going on IR, I tend to think, especially around Sim 3 or Sim 7, I tend to think a trade is coming. Kelly Trepuka came back in response. I know there was a lot of vitriol aimed my way at that. Rather than discussing that specifically, I would just point out that this goes back to a point that I've talked about before on this pod, that if you wish to flip a player in season, especially when it comes to trades with off-season acquisitions, you need to make sure that your timing is right. That trade needs to happen after Sim 3, before Sim 4, and then the flip has to happen after Sim 7 and before the trade deadline in Sim 8. And while Kelly wasn't an off-season signing, some of the players that went to Phoenix were off-season signings in that original Magic Johnson trade, so that trade couldn't have happened until after Sim 3. And so this little window here between Sims 7 and 8 is the only time Phoenix would have had to flip those assets. So whether or not you think it was a good idea for Phoenix to flip those assets, their timing was what allowed this to happen. Had they waited another Sim to make the initial trade, this wouldn't have happened. And obviously they couldn't have made the initial trade prior. So it just kind of, to me, reinforces the idea that generally, if you're going to maximize your opportunities to maneuver your roster, you want to make sure you're paying special attention around Sim 3 and Sim 7. You know, I know we're not always fully in control of our schedules, but it also, you know, talks about, you know, if you have to focus your activity, probably the three times to focus it are off-season, Sims 3 and 7. And I guess if you're in the playoffs, you want to do it for the playoffs too. But generally for team building, those are the key times. And then the last trade I want to talk about is the Suns Bullets proposed trade that was rejected by the league office because it would have left the Bullets over the salary cap. And this was John Long going to the Bullets for Don Collins and points. The reason I want to bring this up is, and we've been hinting at it a little bit on this podcast for a few pods now, the league is accustomed to kind of a free trade type thing where you're not really worried about salary cap ramifications. And this is the first trade that I can remember that was, at least in the new league, that has been busted up due to, hey, this doesn't fit under the salary cap. And as some others have talked about in the town hall, there's a big slew of max contracts coming this offseason. You know, as I mentioned before, of the, you know, the big names this offseason are the 23 players that were selected in the first round of the creation draft. And of those, I would expect 22 of the 23 to be no-brainer max contracts. So that's going to add a ton of salary to the league. I still think there is room to maneuver next season. I think when it becomes really difficult, is once the following season goes through and the first round of rookies get signed to their max level extensions. And the reason I say that is at that point, generally, I guess you have super maxes, but generally contracts are on a four-year rotation. And in the first year of free agency, when we had the players taken at the very end of the creation draft, there wasn't money really being thrown around, certainly not long-term money. The second wave had, the Greg Kelcer max, had the Louis Orr and Lewis Lloyd contracts from the Bucks, but really not a lot of money thrown around. Last season was the first time we saw a lot of money thrown around. Next season, or this coming off season, lots of money going to be thrown around. The following season, lots of money thrown around. But basically what it means is that third and fourth year contracts being the cheap guys, that kind of starts going away after the 1985 season or 84-85 season. And it'll really, really go away after 85-86 when they're, the first, let's say, two free agent classes. I think two players got max deals out of those whole classes, and you could argue they didn't deserve it. But once you've had four free agent classes go through where lots of players were getting max deals, at that point the cap is going to be rough. And so I'll remind everybody again that we have tools for checking your trade legality. The easiest place to find it is probably if you go to the quick links area and go to the GM tools. You've got the cap tools button, and that gives you your trade checker. You can look at your outgoing salaries. You enter the cap space, and you can check whether or not a trade is legal. The other thing, and this is going to be a niche thing to remember, but it is worth keeping in mind, especially for those of you that like to play around the margins of free agency and sign players to better minimum deals, is that if you cut a player, the amount of cap hold which you receive is not equal to his salary. The amount of the cap hold is equal to his salary minus the veteran minimum salary for a player with that many years of experience. So if you sign a player to a veteran min contract and you cut him, all of that salary falls off the books. And I'm going to, for the sake of argument here, use a player on my own team, again, so I can't be accused of trying to blow up anybody else's team. But let's look at Mark Olberding, who I thought it was hilarious that he was even entered into the slam dunk contest, much less won it, having played all of 7 minutes in a single game for me this season. I don't know that he should have even been eligible to be in the slam dunk contest, but I don't make the rules, so what happened happened. And so Olberding has a salary amount of $80,000 this year, and he is a player with 8 years of experience in the league. So if you go to Cap Tools and you look at a player with 8 years of experience, you can see the minimum salary there is $73,490. So for ease of rounding, I'm just going to call that $73,500. Which means if I were to cut his $80,000 salary, I would not take an $80,000 cap hit. I would roughly take a $5,500 cap hit, because that's the difference between the veteran minimum contract and his contract. And so when you're trying to squeeze in a player into a tight salary space, that is something to bear in mind, is that you may be able to cut a minimum player or two to get their salary completely off of your books. And that can be helpful for just barely squeezing somebody in. You run the risk after you cut the player that somebody else might pick them up. But hopefully it was worth it to get the trade in that you were going after. So one little thing to be aware of. And then the other thing to be mindful of, and I think the Clippers kind of showed us this when we talked about their trade, there are probably other teams out there that have cap space to absorb contracts to let you get under the cap. Whether or not you want to pay the price badly enough to get the deal done is probably something that you could debate, you could talk about, you know, whatever you want to call it. You could either do a salary dump individually, or you could try to involve a third team directly in the deal. That's kind of up to you. But, you know, just something to remember, if you are trying to add salary, make sure you don't go over the cap. If you do see that this salary addition is going to take you over the cap, you have the handy cap report link on the index that will show you the list of teams that you can probably reach out to that may be willing to eat your salary, probably for draft picks or points. Now that the Celtics have absorbed the Clippers' salary, the two biggest teams with cap space out there right now are the Spurs, who have almost $2 million, and the Mavericks, who have over $1.5 million. So maybe those are teams that the Bullets and Suns should be reaching out to, saying, "Hey, can we throw some points your way, and you'll, you know, eat some contracts and go from there." The other thing to talk about here, and I'm going to take a quick break to get some water here, is where are teams going? I've seen a couple of buyers, sellers. I do think the playoff picture is much, much clearer after this All-Star sim, which kind of surprised me, but I'm going to take one more fast break, get a drink of water, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about, you know, where are things going here? Okay, so again, that was deliberately a short break. The thing that I did find surprising was the clarity that was brought, especially to the Western Conference race this last sim. The Clippers had been kind of hanging around, and then the bottom kind of fell out this sim. And they went from being in the playoff hunt, at least in the fringes of the playoff hunt, to going 1-5. And that just, I think that probably killed it for them. They went from being within shouting distance of the other playoff teams to 4.5 back of the Jazz, and to being, 7.5 back of the fifth seed. So at least in my mind, the playoff picture is clear in the West. It's the Warriors, Kings, Blazers, Sonics, Lakers, and Jazz. The Clippers and Nuggets are not going to make it. They're probably not going to have great lotto luck, which means the Mavericks, Rockets, Suns, and Spurs are fighting for the lotto, but I think the Spurs have a nice head start there. In the East, the Bucks and the Bullets made a nice move with an 11-game win streak to kind of separate them from the Nets in the Atlantic Division. I do think the Bullets are going to wind up winning the division. I've been kind of surprised at, I thought the Bullets' talent level meant that they would kind of have a cakewalk in the division. It's taken them a while to rise to the top, but then as I look at their home road splits, I realize maybe it was a function of their schedule. They've currently played 29 games on the road and just 21 at home. And so that, you know, we've talked before about, you know, how an imbalanced schedule can really make you look, you know, worse than you are, I guess would be the way to put it. And of course, an 11-game win streak doesn't hurt at all either, kind of pushing them ahead of the Nets. The only real intrigue, at least for me in the East, is who's going to be the sixth seed. I think the Bucks and Bullets are locked in. The Bulls, Nets, and Cavaliers in some order are locked in. I think the Bulls are probably the three seed. Nets and Cavaliers could flip-flop at 4-5. The sixth seed right now is the Pistons. The 76ers or Knicks could catch them. Even the Pacers could get in there. The only teams that I think are out of it are the Hawks and Celtics. The Pistons, 76ers, Knicks, and Pacers seem like teams that don't want to blow everything up and sell out, but they're not all in either. They're in kind of a weird spot. So these are teams that at least the next 24 hours or so before the trade deadline hits, I can see trying to make a move. And the question is, you know, are they going to be able to get help from the teams at the bottom, the Hawks and Celtics, the Suns and Spurs? Probably not. Maybe the Rockets, although I wouldn't count on being able to get the Rockets as a consistent trade partner. The Mavericks might be one. But then again, these are teams that are all flattering themselves. So how much help are you really going to get out of them? I think the Clippers and Nuggets are I don't want to say satisfied where they're at, but they're okay with their rosters as constituted now, looking ahead to next season, which means the thing to watch for the Pistons, the 76ers, the Knicks, and Pacers is, can they find any deals to do with each other? And they're competing with each other. And you know, how do you convince someone that you're trying to fight for that last playoff spot with not only to give it up, but to give you the player or players that gets you over the hump? I'm not sure. I don't know. It's just it fascinates me to watch that dynamic. The most exciting dynamics for me in the league are probably less about the on-paper matchups and more about the ownership decisions and the psychology there. I want to see where that goes. And that kind of leads into, you know, where are we going? I think for the most part, the big trades have kind of stopped. Everybody is more or less kind of hunkering down and waiting for the playoff run, if you're in the playoffs, or waiting for the lotto run, if you're in the lottery, to see, you know, who you're going to get and start planning around that. I just think it's a weird time for the league right now. I think I mentioned in previous pod, seemed like everybody who was going to tank this season kind of made their moves and sold off last season to get ahead of things. And so I don't see a ton of movement coming. There were some talks earlier in some of the town halls about who should make a move. And I think I mentioned this in the last one. We know the Bulls are looking for a power forward. They've made it pretty obvious. They're a good team. Are they a power forward away? I'm not sure. What do they have to give up to get one? I'm not sure. If there's one thing that the league has kind of taught me over the last, I don't know, three seasons, it's that trying to acquire a power forward is not easy. And I'm not really speaking so much to my experience with Dan Brownfield last season. Obviously, I got him as a rental. I didn't know it at the time. I was hoping to bring him back, but I wasn't going to assign him to the max contract. And so I knew in the back of my head I might lose him. But I'm thinking more here about the Lakers, whom we know have been looking for a power forward pretty much since the middle of season one. The Bulls are now looking for a power forward. I think I mentioned in one of my very early pods, it seemed like the power forward position in the league was a little bit thin. And it has fascinated me how the evolution of the position has kind of been either going with a twin tower lineup, so one of your centers becomes your de facto power forward, or trying to use players that have more, quickness, more of a small forwards game with excellent rebounding. I would say, you know, to that point, an example of the first would be the Warriors, where they've got Robert Parrish at center and Moses Malone at power forward, though I think most of us were used to seeing Moses Malone as a center, at least until Parrish showed up. An example of the second would be the Kings, who have their center in Mike Kaminsky, but their de facto power forward for a while was Wes Unseld, but now with his injury, they're probably going to be forced to running a lineup of Bernard King, Calvin Natt, Andrew Toney, and either Vinnie Johnson or Alan Lavelle around Kaminsky, which is a little bit reminiscent of the Lakers with their Jamal Wilkes, World Be Free, Brad Davis, Norm Nixon, and at least until this season, Kelly Tripucka lineup, and now Magic Johnson. They don't have a true power forward, although, as you know, most of us have noted, certainly playing Magic Johnson at power forward has not hurt them in the slightest. So the power forward position has gotten better, I think, but only because talent from other positions has been stuck there. And so those players are now playing power forward in terms of true power forwards. I still think maybe the position was a little bit thin on the ground. I don't know. We'll see. But it does mean that finding that traditional power forward has just been tough. You know, again, we've seen the Lakers trying to do it. We've seen the Bulls trying to do it. And unless you're giving up a ridiculous amount of stuff, it doesn't seem like you're really able to easily fill that position. I do know if I were the Hawks, I would definitely be trying to move Dan Brownfield. But going back to the conversation we had before, that may be a little bit tricky now due to the salary cap. You know, Brownfield makes $1.1 million this season, and that's just going to increase in future seasons. And only the Spurs and Mavericks can afford, well, maybe the Nuggets, can afford to absorb that. So all of these teams that are in contention or think they're close to it, they just don't have the cap space now to absorb those big contracts, meaning they have to give up some talent going out, which they don't seem really willing to do. So, you know, at least to me, I'm not expecting a surprise move prior to the trade deadline. If it happens, I won't be angry about it. I'm just not expecting it. I'm not hearing a lot of rumbles. And I do think, for the most part, everybody has kind of gone to their corner and they're rolling with their team. And that's what we're getting. Because there's just not a lot out there. I do think trading will loosen up after this draft, not just because the draft has happened and so people aren't hoarding for the 84 draft, but I think a lot of the draft picks, which are used as currency, let's be honest, the big currency in this league is draft picks, especially first-round picks, have been moved to the teams that wanted to be in on the 84 draft, and the teams that didn't want to be in on the 84 draft have picked up the talent that they want. The step-in rule means once the 84 picks move around, the 85 picks are difficult to move, and teams, I think, are a little bit wary of moving their 86s. So once we get past the draft, all of those picks that are currently locked up on teams will convert to players. We'll have another fresh round of picks. There aren't a ton of teams with a lot of picks for 85 and later. The Bulls might be your one exception, but generally everybody has their own 86 pick for the most part and their 87 picks. I think we're going to see some more movement once that happens. I guess as an economics person, you'd call it an influx of liquidity into the league. I don't know. You know, like with draft picks, you don't have to worry about cap matching. People generally want them, and I may have mentioned on Discord, I think oftentimes people fall in love with the Schrodinger's cat nature of draft picks. You know, a future draft pick is at once the worst player you can get with that pick and the best player you can get with that pick. And everybody just assumes they're going to grab the best player. And given what I started off the pod with, that for the most part, we're good at grabbing the best players at the top of the draft, maybe that's a fair thing to say, that if I get a top draft pick, I'm going to get a good player. Then the question is, are you sure you're going to get a top draft pick? And the only way to be sure, of course, is A, to have your own draft pick, but that means your team has to suck, or B, is probably to trade for a draft pick just prior to the draft. Going back to my own experience in the 83 or 82-83 season holding the Celtics pick, I thought going into the season that Celtics pick was probably a top three pick. And then they made a couple of trades to spite me and wound up at number 12. So not as good as I would have liked or as good as I would have hoped. But, you know, again, when you don't control a pick, you're not just at the mercy of do I pick the right player or not, but also does the team choose to try to win or not? And that is something that is out of your control. So I guess it deals with your appetite for risk and how much you feel you can take. Anyway, at this point, I think I'm just rambling. If there are big trades, I will probably record another pod at the trade deadline about that. Otherwise, the next pod is almost certainly going to be coming as we're very close to the playoffs and looking at a playoff preview. It's an interesting season for playoffs in the, I don't know in the West if there's an overwhelming favorite. In the East, it's pretty clearly the Bucks. I really do hope that either the Bullets or the Bulls or maybe the Nets or the Cavaliers will be able to pull off a I don't want to say game-changing pick, but let's say a playoff-altering pick to give them more of a chance against the Bucks. But we'll see what happens. At this point, I'm going to wrap things up, and we'll see everybody on the next one. Thanks for joining us for the latest Chat with a Cat.